Good morning. Good morning. My name is Jim Graham, and I'm chairperson of the Committee on Customer Service Operations and Safety. The time is 9:05 on May 8, 2008. I now call to order this meeting of the committee. And I note the presence of a quorum with Mr. Zimmerman and Mr. McKay and Mr. Graham and Mr. Benjamin and Ms. Hewlett. Brothers, if there are others, I think this is sufficient to proceed.
Yes, it is.
Yes, thank you. And so we have the approval of the agenda. Is there a discussion on the agenda? Discussion on the agenda, hearing none. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The ayes have it. Is there a discussion on the minutes of April the 10th? Is there a motion to approve the minutes as if read?
So moved.
And moved. Second. Is there amendments, deletions, modifications,
no,
comments?
No, they're very good minutes.
Excellent minutes. Okay. So all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The ayes have it. The minutes are approved. Now we go to, we have several information items, and the reason we have these most particularly is, of course, we have agreed to review the operational performance very appropriately at every meeting of this committee, and I think that is time well spent. And in addition, we have added these new items on public safety, which are also a very important inquiry by this committee, since no one corrected me when I said that we have that responsibility, because it's under safety, I suppose.
Yes.
And so nobody said no, so here we go. All right, good. So now we begin. Mr. Cato, good morning.
Good morning.
Do you wish to proceed from here, please?
Yes. Mr. Francis will make the presentation this morning on the operations performance, and then I will introduce the other people who make a presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Cato, Mr. Graham, and committee members. In January of this year, I reported to the committee our November on-time performance numbers, which revealed an on-time performance of 89%. At that time, and we had a lot of discussion, but our commitment in Metro and my commitment was to go back and look at each section of the operating department. And what I mean by that, look at our TSSM section, which is our infrastructure portion, our transportation portion, and also our vehicle portion. And what we did was we kind of broke it down to take a look at what could cause us service interruptions and to help us attribute our goal of 95% or over on on-time performance. And if I could rewind for a minute, we started with the infrastructure portion. That's when I made a presentation to the committee that we went in and we cleaned up a lot of trash along this infrastructure, and what that did was eliminated some of the wayside problems we were having and interruptions, but it also brought the on-time performance up probably about a percentage and a half, or almost 2%. And we continued doing that. We continued to monitor and manage the data that we had in order to raise the on-time performance. I'm happy to tell the committee today that our on-time performance, overall on-time performance for the month of March is 94%. That's 1% lower than our goal, but we're making strides to get there. We've made strides each month by anywhere from 1, 3, or 5 percentage points. But I'm also happy to report to the committee as well is that two of our lines, the red line and the orange line, is at 95% on-time performance. Our yellow line is at 94%. And, excuse me, our blue and our green line is at 92%. So we're working extremely hard to not only achieve our goal, but to continue to provide quality service to our customers. Someone once told me that what measures the performance of your service is to provide quality service to the customer, and that's what we're doing. And the measurement tool that we're using is also through our customers, both internal and external. And our supervisors have given us pretty good feedback on what we need to do to adjust service at the time. Also wanted to point out at this time that there's a lot of people behind the scenes in doing this, with supervisors, controllers, our management personnel. But what I show you at these committee meetings are a highlight of the information that we take, but there's reams of information that we use to accomplish this task. Go to the next slide. This is one example of what we've talked about in each meeting. This goes over the subsystems for our rail car failures, but we use this as a managing tool to look at any failure that exceeds 3 minutes. Now, the next slide will probably be a little bit more of interpretation, but if you look at the automatic train control, for example, this covers the 90-day period. You see in January, our automatic train control interruptions, service interruptions, were like 65. And for the month of March, we reduced that almost in half. Now, these are failures that are attributable to rail car failures or wayside failures, but we're able to go out and manage those. We do preventative maintenance now on the signals and switches, and we also have operating plans, service recovery plans that will get us through some of these service delays when they occur. Brake malfunctions, you can see we reduced them slightly. Doors are pretty much even, and that's going to be a challenge for us from this point on because they're the most usable piece of equipment on our system. And customer-related and others is a category that I label as uncontrollable. It's things that happen on the trains to our customers, such as when they get sick or any type of disturbances happens on there. We have to try to address those, but we do have service recovery plans as well. Next slide.
I don't know, what is your pleasure? Do you want to have questions as we're going along, or do you
that
want
would
to
be
finish the entire presentation?
You might want to do questions as you go along with this before, but I don't have a suggestion.
I think because sometimes it's hard to go back, and I just have a quick question. This won't take about a minute, but I've been forwarding to Mr. Cato questions about the sick passenger. It seems to be, have we reviewed, and that would be under the customer related, we reviewed our protocols on how to deal with that. Needing attention of one kind.
We have reviewed our protocols, and I would say, Mr. Graham, we have to address those on a case-by-case basis because it depends on the medical emergency that the customer is having at that time. At some time, it might lead us an opportunity that if the emergency is not as serious, for example, we might be able to have a station manager meet the customer and stay with him or her until medical service comes. And at times, the medical condition that happens on the car does not allow us to actually move the person that's inside. So the best answer that I can give to that is to evaluate it on a case-by-case basis when the operator calls it in.
How much delay is, on average, is being caused? Of course, it varies, I suppose, according to the gravity of the situation.
It would, and I don't...
The delay is it causing...
I don't know, at times I can give you a range, depending on the emergency, it could be anywhere from 10 minutes, it could be 50 minutes. But what would happen in that...
It's an average. You don't have to give it now, but...
I can give you an average.
We'll look at it and give it to us the next time.
I can do that.
So we get a sense of... I think I've had... Have we had three emails on this? It seems like... They're all from the same person or different?
If I recall, they're from... Two different people, but
well, if you could come back to us next month, is someone keeping track of our request?
Yes, several people are.
All right, our bus mean mean distance between failure for the month of March. The mean distance between failure was 68.56. Slightly down from the previous month, but above the goal. I think in the last committee meeting, Mr. Monomy asked a question I might have answered it wrong in reference to, does this encompass the whole fleet? And yes, it does. The second graph I just wanted to point out, too, is that I highlighted our buses that we've had since about the 2004-05 time frame. CNG hybrid and clean diesel, just to give you a look at what the mean distance between failure was for each one of those fleets. I guess you can't. You have to look at it on a hard copy. Next slide. Our escalator and elevator reliability on escalators is at 94.1%. And on our elevators is 96.6%. And Mr. Graham, one of the things that I did on this report as well was to, I'm trying to break down the availability during both our peak rush hours. For the month of March, you can see our vertical transportation was available 94% of the time for both the AM and PM periods. And on elevators, it was 96% of the time. Next slide. This is our top 12 escalators with the most non-scheduled outages, and this is something that we looked at before. For a 90-day period, you asked us to add some additional columns on there, and I'll kind of go through Shaw as an example. You know, we listed the station and the unit of the escalator that was had problems. The availability on the Shaw escalator, for example, was 84%. But it was out of service 23 times.
Is that 23 days or is it 23 incidents?
23 incidents.
Incidents. So 23. It might be out of service for 5 minutes.
Could be.
Or
exactly.
Half an hour or an hour.
Exactly.
Might be.
So it was 23 incidents and it was attributable to 67 hours.
Well, it's 23 incidents attributable to 67 hours, and is it fair to say we can divide 67 by 23
and get an average
approximation?
You get an average, but that might not really describe the issue, because if you look at what the comments are, some of those can be reset by the station manager. Others, like the adjustments, take much more time. So you could do the math and say the average, but the reality is, I think the three adjustments take a far greater period of time than the others.
See, so we could assume 20 reset of safety switches, anyone in the station manager can do that?
In some cases, in other cases, they have to call in the escalator repair staff.
Mr. Cato is right. You call in the elevator escalator service, but I was going to add to this, 74% of those breakdowns were reset by our Ellis personnel.
But very quickly.
Very quickly.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Quick comment or question. Thank you. Question about just the resets. Are those tripped or set off by individuals, or is that something that's system? What's a reset? Seems like it's a fundamental thing. Is it triggered by something in the machinery, or is it actually triggered by somebody getting a shoe caught or a sandal caught?
Well, it could be, yes. They have a what's called a comb plate feature in the escalators that if you're exactly right, if a shoestring, sweater, shoe gets caught in there, then the safety feature would kick in and shut it down. We have the emergency buttons on the side. Unfortunately, sometimes those get depressed, shut the escalator down, and then we have to go into calling the Ellis personnel to have to respond and reset.
Mr. Chairman, my thinking here is that the information that we really want is everything less the resets, because the resets are simple outages that typically don't take too much time. It's not machinery error. We're focused on is something wrong with the actual physical plant being damaged or impacted in some way, and that's what drives. So we can kind of focus on the ones that are real mechanical issues and see if they're repeating themselves time over time versus the ones that are just individuals doing something or accidentally pushing a button, so we can kind of know the ones that we're seeing habitual and recurring.
Well, let me make sure, for clarification purposes, if we do that, for an example, the Shore escalators would not be in the top 12. Because there's only really three mechanical issues there, even though the availability is very low, 84%, it's lower than our system average significantly. The majority of those because of safety switches, not because of mechanical problems. So when we come back to show you that, Shore would probably not be on the list. It would be some other locations.
I guess my thought is, well, there's two things. There's a management issue. If it's a reset, then we just need somebody to be mindful of the escalator need to be reset. It's a mechanical issue. That's what's driving costs, what's driving air response time, and that's what I think we spend a lot of our time and energy focusing on, ones that are habitual air issues.
And that's the whole purpose of this top 12 thing that you've described. You know, but if you look at Addison Road, here you've got these same kind of easy to deal with reset issues, but then you've got two safety inspections. So if we proceed on the assumption of what you've just said, which is that the resets are easy, and the inspections tied up this escalator at Addison Road, unit number one, nearly 100 hours.
Well, when we say the resets are easy, they're easy to go in and restart the escalator. But it is someone, we do not have the escalator repair people at every location. it takes them a period of time to arrive there, and as a result of that, that time adds up, particularly if there's 19 separate occasions. Those hours and those minutes add into hours, and then the inspection comes back and address the rest of the hours. But I can, we can give you a breakdown on the average.
But see, the point of all, you know, we could easily get lost in this forest, and I don't think that's where I want to be.
Okay.
The point of this is what Mr. Monomay has said very well, which is we're trying to get a higher level view of just what is creating this problem at these dozen units, and then what are we doing to so that we don't have so many hours, because were you to total up all the hours here, you seem to have more than 12. Do I have a double sheet? Oh, it's a different month, yeah.
5 months.
Sorry. So, I mean, if we were to total up all these hours, it's fairly significant. This is just 12. So what would you say more generally about this information? What can you, what more general conclusion can you provide us with?
I think it's pretty much on the line of what you just discussed. The reset safety switches and that type of thing is something that we can address in a relatively short period of time. I think we want to look at now is going into what I call hard failures or the mechanical failures that may limit the liability of the escalators for a period of time, and what do we do to address those? So we'll go back and take a look at the information that Mr. Monomay suggested, or the comments that Mr. Monomay suggested, as well as you, Mr. Graham, and just see what we can come up with. And
what causes the need to have a reset safety?
There could be several things. Sometimes people push the button, and that shuts down the escalator. We have that, unfortunately, to happen on a lot of occasions. On other occasions, debris could get caught into the escalator, and that sets off the safety trap. The safety trip, or I guess you call it. And if someone's like shoe gets stuck in the edge on the side, that would trigger the escalator to shut down. And on other occasions, if people, there's a large number of people on the escalator and they're jumping up and down, that would shut it down. That's a safety feature built in to all escalators.
Mr. Zimmerman.
I want to understand some of this a little bit better. What exactly is the unit column telling us?
The unit column is if you may have anywhere from 2-4 escalators at a station, so that's unit 2. That's the number that's on the escalator. Sometimes when you call it in, you may say number 2 is out of service or number 1 is out of service.
Okay, but
so it's the second of one of two escalators maybe.
Yeah, or some stations
or
that have
second
more.
Of 5 or 6, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
How many escalators are there at Metro Center?
35.
And how many are there at Clarendon? Boy, that's good. Yeah. Do that for all 83 stations.
Please don't push it.
That's the thing that I wondered about when I saw the table. We're ranking these by station, but I wonder if that's even what's relevant, because there's different units, and my guess is, and we have different units that were purchased at different times from different manufacturers, and I'll bet we even have, in one station, we may have by different manufacturers in the same place, I'm guessing.
Sure.
So, you know, what the real question is, what are the escalator units that are, you know, continually a problem? And when you rank them this way, I just kind of wonder, because if there's only... You know, I mean, I just wondered how Clarendon, which is basically a low-volume station, you know, winds up so high there. You know, Metro Center, it seems like, well, of course, if you say any time there's an escalator outage, that counts, and you're ranking that way, then they're going to make the list because they just got so many escalators. Whereas maybe the Clarendon one actually shows that there's a real problem unit. But I don't know, and I can't tell from this table, so I'm not sure. I understand the concept of, you know, looking at the ones that are persistently failing, but I'm wondering if we're losing more than we're gaining by the way we've got these aggregated.
Okay.
And I think what you're saying, what I hear you saying, is that where you have fewer escalators, the impact of a unit number two like at Shaw, you know, may be much higher than when you have a great many escalators, but you have at Metro Center.
Just as one example, but I'm not entirely sure, but somehow it seems to me it ought to matter that you've got a big station with multiple entrances and multiple units.
Sure.
Is different
how many escalators are there at Shaw?
Six.
So it's much smaller.
Yes.
And one being out persistently could really affect the station because there's fewer alternatives, you know.
I think let us go back and try to work on this. We might want to look at it, if possible, by manufacturer to see if there is any particular manufacturer of escalator that gives us more problems than others. And taking into account the number of escalators at a location, you're right, at Metro Center, if you look at the issues, it's far smaller.
Well, let me throw out a different one for you to think about. Okay. One of the things that's also not shown here, I don't know where, there's some kind of cycle for rehab of these things. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that when they made the decisions about which ones to do, those that get a lot of use got overhauled sooner. I mean, I don't know, but I'll, for the sake of argument, let's suppose that's true. If that were true, then that might explain, for instance, why Clarendon would be up there and Ballston or Roslyn not, which is something that immediately I wondered about. What we've got is the busiest stations aren't showing there, and one of the lightest stations is. And why would that be? Well, just purely speculation, but one possibility could be that the busy stations got overhauled more recently because they were more heavily used, and the lighter station maybe with like older equipment running more to the end of life and hasn't been gotten to yet. That, you know, pure speculation, but what we're doing here is trying to find patterns. So
that's what we're doing. Mr. McKay?
Help me understand the safety switches. Where would those be located? Because you mentioned sometimes, I guess, customers might hit them, and I guess, you know, my question is, where are they located? Who's authorized to hit them? And are they in the same place with every manufacturer?
So, there's a number of different safety switches in escalators, and they're designed to protect the public from injuries if they become caught in the unit. And typically, they're located at the top and bottom comb plates in case something goes under the comb plate. They also have safety switches along the side we call skirt panels, the metal panels that are next to the step. So if an object were to become wedged between the step and that metal panel, it would activate a switch. There are switches that sense the handrail speed. So if the handrail starts running faster or slower than the steps, it would activate the handrail switches. We also have switches that detect if a step, when we come, we call it the transition, when you come to the top or the bottom, the steps level out. If there's something holding one of those steps up and preventing it from dropping down, there's a switch that will sense that. And, you know, typically, those switches are activated, you know, inadvertently. You know, someone standing too close to the side will, you know, kick the side of the escalator at the right, at the very right place, and activate one of those switches. If there's a whole bunch of people with baby carriages and stuff, that tends to hang up the step switch, and if you have the baby carriage wheels pushed up against the step in front of you, that'll keep the step from coming down. The comb switch is designed to detect if something goes under the comb, but it's also subject to heavy loads on top because it deforms the comb. So if somebody jumps on the comb plate when they're getting, you know, if they're running to a train and they jump on the comb plate on their way off, that'll activate those switches. And then there's always the emergency stop button, which, you know, has a tendency to be kind of like pranked.
So can you draw any conclusions where we're having safety switches? I mean, when I look at the 2 months, I'm seeing a lot of different stations on there. So I guess I would assume that we don't have a chronic problem with a number of reset safety switches in any particular station that could be There could be a factor with the design of the station or the clearance area at the bottom of an escalator or something like that that may be increasing the number of triggers on a month-to-month basis. Do you have any ideas to whether or not these four or five stations over a longer period of time than the last 2 months seem to have a disproportionate number of safety switches? That could be a factor of something besides just the equipment, but something related to the design or maybe where the switch happens to be on a particular unit that could be more accessible.
There, a lot of times, it's the number of people that go through the station. I mean, the more riders that use a unit, the more the safety switches get activated. Sometimes there's adjustments, and that's one of the things that we look at on this list. If we see excess safety switch activations, we'll go out and look at the unit and see if perhaps one of them is out of adjustment, maybe, you know, a little too sensitive. But at the end of the day, these switches, you know, need to work when they're supposed to work, and we can't have to keep them at a certain level of sensitivity, because if they don't work when we need them, we're going to be looking at a disaster.
Okay, well now if we go further, we see a similar situation in terms of elevators. Mm-hmm. And then I'm trying to keep us a little bit on schedule.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you look at escalator elevators not functioning, which is on page 20, first you get to the more serious situation. I think is to get next time some more generalized conclusions. You know, and of course, our signage is much improved.
Yes, it has. I have that at the end of the presentation as well.
And I do want to say on the positive note that I don't see Brookland with an escalator problem, which is, that's been one of the longstanding.
Yes.
Issues, and so we appear to have, I don't know, maybe there are other escalators and elevators elsewhere which continue to be long-standing. Brookland has been one of the worst. Okay, are there any further questions on the escalator elevator issue, Mr. Zimmerman?
Well, just to clarify, I think what we've, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Chairman, I think we're asking staff, well, we were engaged in some speculation ourselves trying to look at patterns in here, but I think what we're asking is that the staff do some analysis I took from your last comment, and that they come back and tell us what they do or don't find, and you know, to what degree their analysis supports a particular conclusion, because that's really what's going to guide us to some kind of policy decision. I have a specific one I'd like to ask.
And action.
Yeah, exactly.
Action pursuant.
We also talked about the Roslyn platform elevator, the one that goes between the platforms, and I just was wondering. That's one taken out of station, basically, and it didn't seem like it's, last time I was there, it was not tied up, but nobody was working on it. Seems like it's out for a long time.
That's
one of the busiest stations in Northern Virginia.
Yeah, but
if you don't know,
this is the CIP?
Yeah, the elevator's out.
Yeah, we have an elevator out at Roslyn for,
months.
As part of the capital improvement.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's scheduled to go back in on May 26th.
And you expect that it will be going in?
Yes.
Okay.
You have a sign.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I do have a question to go back to when you're done with escalator and elevator.
You want to finish your escalator elevator segment?
I pretty much think we covered them, Mr. Graham, on the elevators, and you just spoke to the non-functioning portion of it. I am finished with the escalator elevator portion.
So let's just round out Metro Access, and then we'll go back to your questions. All right.
All right. On Metro Access, and I've reported this each month, the ridership keeps continuing to grow. It's from 4,900 to over 5,200 as we speak. The on-time performance is 92%. I think what's a plus is that. But still, we're very successful at improving the customer service and reducing the the missed and late trips. If you look at the graph below, previous month in February, it was at 1.8 and we're down to 1.5. So even though the ridership is continuing to grow, the Metro Access Service personnel are doing a good job of balancing the equipment versus taking care of our customers. But one last thing I was going to, well, if you want to take Mr. Zimmerman's question.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to point out, I don't know if you can see it on the screen, but in the last committee meeting, we spoke about the signage, and you just got through mentioning that. So we're working closely with our marketing department as well to try to get the signage to better say exactly what the issue and the problem is, and to put a date on there. It's going to come back in. You can see that's an example of some of the signage that's been out at the escalator and elevators.
Mr. Francis, let me say this is a massive. You have been able to achieve what heretofore has been seemingly unachievable. And so I just want to, I'm sure everybody is very pleased. I'm particularly pleased to see this because I think this is going to address a lot of our customer reaction. It's a simple step, but it's one we've had kind of a difficult time with prior to your work. And so I want to commend you for this. The one thing I would add before we go to Mr. Zimmerman on Metro Access, and I don't want to, you know, overburden you with requests for reports and information, but I would ask you to add to this for the future, the free ride, how we're doing in terms of the free ride, and how many people are using it, or anything you have on the free ride option for those who are disabled would be helpful just as an additional draft.
Usage by the regular system by Metro Access.
Right, the people who are taking it. Any light you can shed on that would be very interesting for me and perhaps for others.
We will bring that back in.
Okay, good. Now, Mr. Zimmerman.
Let me just, on the point I was making before on the Roslyn station, just to be clear, one of the reasons I raised that previously was just the period of time that the elevator would be out and the impact that particular one has on the busiest station in Northern Virginia. And it seems like there's just sort of a standard, this is how we do the elevator, and it takes 3 months, and that's it. And I would think that there's a difference between, say, a redundant elevator. I mean, if it's the fourth elevator that we have going in and out of Boston now because we do have some redundancy there, if it was out 3 months, wouldn't be a big deal. Two of them could be out 3 months. At this point, wouldn't be that big a deal. Take one out in the Roslyn platform, and the station is out. And it's a major transfer station. So I would have thought that when you approach these, that that would come into consideration. And certain ones that are major bottlenecks, you know, you work around the clock. And the thing is, every time I've been by there, I've never seen anybody working on it. Now, I know they are, but my guess is they're doing the same kind of schedule because it's the standard schedule to do. And I'd ask you to take a look at that, whether you okay. allocate resources differently. And it's not going to matter for Roslyn at this point, but there are other points around the system where, you know, maybe we ought to concentrate because, you know, when, as my colleague here pointed out, when you do a major bridge or the mixing bowl or something like that, you know there's a high volume, then you devote more resources to that than you would to one that isn't as critical. That's my thought. But I actually wanted to ask about bus. I was struck by the fact that in this, you know, whole report, which is very good and important that we do, there's one page on bus, and, you know, you understand.
Yes.
I still don't see a measure for any kind of schedule adherence, which I think is what's most needed for bus. But the one page we do have shows something interesting, and that specifically is page 12, by the way. The mean distance between failure by fleet. And what it shows is that among the three classes of vehicle that we operate by propulsion systems, diesel, natural gas, and hybrid, we're getting pretty good performance out of our CNG and diesel buses. Some months the CNG does better, some months the diesel does better, but they're both basically, you know, well over 20,000, let's say. What's striking is the hybrids are performing so much more poorly. For instance, in the most recent month, we have CNG at over 22,000, diesel at over 20, almost 24,000, and hybrid at 9,155. In fact, for the last 4 months, it's been under 10,000. And that's a pretty striking difference.
I'm going to ask Mr. Victoria to address that issue.
Good morning. A couple of committee meetings ago, Phil Wallace was here, and he showed an issue that we were having, one of the components of the bus. That is being worked on, and we should see some improvement in the next few months on that. The manufacturer is working with us. As you can see, though, typically it's somewhere around 12,000-13,000 miles between road calls on the hybrids. Now that also is below what the other two types of buses are, but that's typical for the industry.
I think typical that hybrids, not just us, hybrids just don't do as well as the others.
They typically don't do as well as the others. However, you'll see that, for example, on the clean diesel and the CNG, at this agency, we are getting much higher miles between road calls than is typical for the industry as well.
We're doing very well with those. Which kind of makes the contract, you know, makes it even more striking, because it suggests our people are pretty good, probably.
Mm-hmm. They are.
So, you know, at any rate, so that's one thing. In the replacement order, you know, our bus replacements, what are we ordering?
For the 40-foot buses, we're ordering hybrid vehicles, and it was, yes. Yeah.
So we're ordering more of those that perform the most poorly and cost 60% more per bus. I would be interested to see some information, Mr. Cato, if staff to put together on what's happening with fuel costs. I'm interested both in terms of what we are actually paying based on the way we do our contracts for fuel, and what you know, what's going on in the market otherwise, if you know, because obviously we may be locked in at various points and that can help us or hurt us, but you know, see the contrast, and also what the relative costs are now of diesel and natural gas, given, you know, the recent changes in the market and what I believe is a gap that has opened wider between the diesel fuel and CNG. But if something we worked up there, that'd be
we can do that. We have some numbers today, but not to the degree that you're speaking of the comparison.
Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, okay. But I would like in the future, Mr. Chairman, to see a little bit more about the performance of our bus service. Because I think the 450,000 or so passengers that ride it each day deserve some attention as well.
Okay. Anything further for Mr. Francis? Mr. Francis?
Actually, it's for Mr. Vittori, just following up on the same thing that Mr. Zimmerman was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that it was a control mechanism or something that was causing the problem with the hybrids.
That's correct.
As opposed to something basic to the way the hybrids operate?
Yes.
And I thought the last time when Phil Wallace was for us, he said that he thought that would be fixed very quickly. It doesn't seem to be happening.
Actually, it's scheduled to be completed by the middle of May.
And then what is your expectation as to what will happen to the reliability of this bus?
Well, it should go back to what it was in the past, as you can see in the previous months, somewhere between 12,000-13,000.
So you don't expect it to go up to where the other buses are, or?
No, we don't. As I said earlier, if you look at the 22 and 23,000 miles between road calls and the other two, that is unusually high.
Okay, so what's the reason that the hybrids are lower? Nationally or here?
Nationally.
Why? What is it?
Well, I can tell you that if you look at the national figures for all others, not just CNG or hybrids, but even diesel, they're much lower than ours.
Yeah, I guess the question I'm asking is, hybrids seem to not perform here, at least, and you're saying also nationally, as well as the other two. What is it about a hybrid that causes that to be the case?
I would imagine it's somewhat of a new technology, and there's still some bugs with it. I couldn't give you an exact answer.
Some analysis and performance standards being developed, and let us go back and research those and bring those back to you. I have heard the same comment when I was at the bus conference in Austin with other providers, that they're not achieving the same mileage between road calls. And so there is some work being done on this. Let us go and look at the research and then bring it back to you.
Because Mr. Zimmerman has brought up a very important issue, and we certainly need to understand it. Certainly as we move forward and determine what it is that we're going to be buying in the future,
We need to know whether we have an inherent problem or a transitional problem or a phasing problem, what that is.
It could be one of the two. My experience has been, I recall when agencies first began putting into service compressed natural gas buses, the mileage between the road calls was low in the beginning. And as we became more efficient with what to look for, what to repair, what to do preventative maintenance on, the mileage started to increase. I suspect that's going to happen here. However, I would like to go back and look at the research on it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Further from Mr. Frank? Thank you very much. There's a lot of progress in this report. Now, do we go to
the Chief.
Chief Tabor?
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Chairman Graham, other members of this committee. Thank you for affording me the opportunity to give an overview of the Metro Transit Police. What I will briefly do this morning is to talk about our jurisdiction, how we deploy our personnel, crime statistics, and information about the cameras throughout our system. I'll also talk briefly about our look ahead, where we want to go in the future.
Let me interrupt, Chief, because we have another committee today. And so I'm mindful of that agenda. And so I'm going to, can you do your presentation in 5 minutes?
Yes, sir, I can.
So that we can then get, if there are any questions, we can get to the questions. Would you mind?
Sir. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Good. This morning, most of you are aware that the Metro Transit Police was created through Public Law 94306, signed by President Ford on June 4th, 1976. This establishment of the police department talked about what our duties, roles, and responsibilities were, how we police, that we had jurisdiction on properties owned, controlled, or operated by the authority of crimes committed on, to, or against. Public Law 94306 provided with an addendum in April of 1988 that spoke to the bus stops and that we, in fact, had jurisdiction within 150 feet of those bus stops. That was done so that we can ensure that our patrons were afforded protection. Going back to deployment, we currently have an authorized strength of 420 police officers, 130 non-sworn positions. Majority of these police officers are assigned to the Field Operations Division, which is responsible for the day-to-day protection of our patrons throughout the system. We also have 48 in field services, which are primarily administrative, and 46 that are assigned to the protective services that constitutes the revenue protection. We have 8 plainclothes officers assigned to the Metro Rail, 16 in the buses. We have a variety of deployment initiatives. We have special response team in the event there's a terrorist attack or some type of hostage. We have evidence technician, bicycle patrols, things that you would find in your traditional law enforcement agencies. We have K-9 teams, many of which were provided by the Transportation Security Administrations, both drug, explosive, and regular patrol dogs. Deployment, we have targeted train inspection, which is consists of a large number of uniform administrative officers that saturate random Metro Rail stations during rush hour to inspect trains for suspicious items and activities. We have the height, which is uniform plainclothes officers that go and work on specific Metro bus routes in response to trends or crimes or generated complaints. We have the rail anti-crime targeted shifts, again, plainclothes officers assigned to Metro Rail to target robberies, bike thefts, vandalisms, and enforce a public conduct ordinance. They also work with the schools. Looking here from 2003 to 2008, these are the Part 1 crimes that constitute your major crimes, felonies, and you'll see that aggravated assaults is consistent, 98 throughout the year. Currently, to date, we have 18. We go down to the larcenies, which makes up the preponderance of the crimes that we experience in the Metro system, and they are directly connected to the number of parking spaces that we have throughout the system. We go down to the next to the last, or the robberies, which also is extremely high. Last year we had 414, 144 to date this year. The next slide depicts, we feel that it's important that we address all crimes, but statistically speaking, the top bar represents the jurisdictional agencies throughout the Metro zone and the types of, again, Part 1 crimes. And at the bottom, you see a flat line that really constitutes the crimes that you can find within the Metro system that, statistically speaking, is very small. Next slide. You'll see the stations that we're experiencing the most crimes in calendar year 2007. And again, New Carrollton leads that followed by Franconia, Springfield, and the one station in the District of Columbia, Anacostia. Again, we look at crime statistics versus ridership, and you'll find that the New Carrollton, right around 3 million people per year. Vienna has the highest ridership, and the crime is proportional at the bottom chart. In 2006, 127 assaults on bus operators. In 2007, there were 86. So far this year, there have only been 18, but 18 is 18 too many. For 2007, 80% of the reported assaults occur in the District of Columbia, and you see the statistics, 11 in the state of Maryland, 6 in the Commonwealth of Virginia. We've instituted a variety of different patrol methodologies. We increased the size of the plainclothes police officers assigned to the Metro bus. This depicts the bus routes experiencing the high levels of incidents. Majority of those sort of centered in the District of Columbia. We're working with the jurisdictional agencies, Metropolitan Police Department, to attack this particular crime. In 2007, this is just a calls for service and how many arrests that were made, 1,526, how many citations or were issued, traffic citations, things of that nature. The last bullet depicts that the probability of being a victim of a Part 1 crime in the metro system is 2.09 per million customers. This is information relative to the camera systems throughout the systems. You'll find over 1,000 cameras throughout the metro rail, and there's also 715 buses that are equipped with at least 5 cameras. In 2006, November, a camera was installed at the U Street station. The camera is mounted above, so it's obvious to the patrons, and we feel that that is in direct correlation to the reduction of crime in and around that area. To remain an elite organization, what we are planning to do is to institute an assessment, to look at our police agencies, to look at what we do, why we do it, how we measure what we do, to look at the data, to analyze where we need to be, and to sort of drive that in the future. Next slide. Again, establish a vision for the future. We're going to establish a 5-year strategic plan as we look to expand the metro systems. People that are retiring, we have to factor in where we need to be now so that we can plan for the future. Next slide. I think that's it. What I would also want to briefly say is that next week, starting Monday, begins National Police Week, and we have representatives from our jurisdiction that have paid the ultimate sacrifice, killed in the line of duty, so we want to recognize those people next week. Metro Transit Police also have 2 officers that are on the wall across the way, so please support Police Week.
Chief Taborn, I want to congratulate you. I did not think it would be possible to make that in 5 minutes. Not only did you cover a lot of material, but you hit the high points really, really well.
Thank you, sir.
I can ditto that. Mayor?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, Chief, how often, I mean, how, yeah, collaboration with other police departments, how often did that occur?
We do it on a daily basis. We have the various committees of the Council of Government, so there's the police chiefs, and there's probably about 30 different committees. We're working primarily with the Auto Theft Committee that is responsible for trying to come up with strategies that address the problems that we throughout the metropolitan area experiencing with respect to the auto thefts and the breaking and the stealing of the GPS and the catalytic converters. So we meet on a daily basis and we reach out to them.
And you know, with the total number of statistics, the data that showed the total number of crimes and so forth, arrests, obviously that involves manpower time in terms of going to court.
Absolutely.
Prosecution. Do you have an idea or can you calculate what that cost is? I know it's been a big issue in my city in the past in terms of, you know, most of our office, many of our office spend more time in court than they are out on the street.
Absolutely. I don't have those figures right away, but as you stated, court time, training, there's a lot that goes into the requirements of personnel, and quite often it means that there aren't people on the street. So we work diligently to make sure that we try to structure our training. We encourage the officers to go out and make the arrest, so we can't do a lot about court time.
Thank you.
Mr. McKay?
Yes. I'm actually, you know, the auto theft numbers at Franconia and Springfield are a little bit troubling, but The one thing I don't see in here, we have crime versus station ridership, but there's no real context given to the auto theft component. In other words, Brent County Springfield has enormous parking capacity and enormous use, so we don't see, you know, 42 auto thefts doesn't really tell you what percent of the parkers, you know, at that station are being affected. So just as we've done with ridership, I'd like to actually see the auto theft in the context of the station capacity for parking so that we can get a relative percent.
Okay, sir.
Thank you.
Ms. Hewlett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Chief Taborn. I, too, have to commend you for a very salient report within 5 minutes. So
thanks.
That's very impressive. So I am looking at page 43 of 60 and looking at the stations with the experiencing the most crime. And as a Prince George's representative, I'm really happy about this. I wanted to know a couple of things. Number one, you said you have increased the number of plainclothes police officers now?
Primarily for the buses and the
buses,
for the bus assaults.
And for those on the rail system, how effective have the plainclothes police officers?
On the rail system, very effective. They've been combating robbery, pickpockets, things of that nature. They also work with a variety of schools throughout the metropolitan area with the jurisdictional police agencies. But there's a lot of territory that we have to cover.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there is a lot of territory to cover. I was just kind of wondering, because I would imagine seeing the police officer in uniform would be a deterrent in and of itself. The plainclothes are probably, you know, see things that that the others might not, just because by virtue of the uniform. So are more police officers being deployed there to, I mean, you have like 7 Prince George's County stations on there, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, that's pretty bad.
We have an auto theft unit. We have people that are on disability that we employ as the eyes and the ears, and so if there's something, issues, they can call into the police officer. We have motorcycles. We have a variety of different collaborative efforts with the local jurisdictions. But again, they're facing many of the same problems that we're facing. So to the best of our ability, we try to attack those areas that are experiencing crime, whether that be in the parking lots, robberies, things of that nature.
Okay, that's it for me for now. But I'd like to, I'll talk to you some more.
I understand. That's right.
Mr. Bonneman?
Just real quickly, I know that one of the things that transit has really dealt with over the last few years is dealing with your retirement and issues, competition with the federal government, security issues. I want to know if there's any thinking. As I was looking at the strategic plan, I thought would be that would be a key part as you look forward over the next few years. Any thoughts on that?
Absolutely. We're going to be looking at everything from the beginning to the end. We're going to be looking at our policies, procedures, how we do what we do, our deployment, our organizational efficiency to find out if, in fact, we have the people working the right schedules, the right times. And recruitment is a major thing, because in the metropolitan area you have probably 40 local, state, and federal police departments that are all vying for the same person. So we're going to extensively look at going outside. We haven't been as successful with the military, which was a place to go several years ago, but because of deployment, we're finding other places to go.
Another follow-up. I saw you listed some special services that you provided. Still the fair. Money service still being provided?
Yes, sir, it is. We're looking at that, too, in ways to do it differently, do it better, to be more effective.
Thank you very much. Let me just make a couple of points. First, I want to emphasize your statement, Chief, that the probability of being a victim of one of these Part 1 crimes in the metro system is almost 3 per million customers.
Yes,
and so I think we need to emphasize the fact that we have a very safe system here, and that message needs to be put out so that people feel secure about riding bus and train and metro access. I just wanted to say a couple things about the camera systems. The fact that we have 1,800 nearly 1,800 cameras between the buses and the metro rail system is very impressive. And then some of the buses are equipped with 5 cameras each, which brings us to a total of 3,575 cameras in the system, which is, I don't know how this compares to other cities, but it's certainly a large number here. Does it compare favorably to other cities?
Yes, it does, but we're making efforts to expand that. It's one of the objectives of this year is to outfit all of the buses with cameras and add additional cameras in certain rail locations.
One of the things that I found in dealing with cameras in the District of Columbia is that having cameras is one thing. Effectively using the cameras record is quite another. And we have had several experiences with this. We're getting a feedback on these mics. I notice it's not just mine, but
I'm not going to move that one away from yours.
This one away from, whoops, and it goes toward you.
Move the other one.
It's a very aged system.
More infrastructure needs.
But just so we don't, is that better? Is that better? Because I think I was picking it up on yours too. Anyway, we're just not very effectively using what the cameras are recording. And what is the life of the recording in a Metro Rail system camera?
The life, we can retrieve it. Can retrieve anything for an investigative purpose.
All right. So, of course, that underscores the point that we got to get to these cameras, you know, if we have an incident. And we had, as you know, Mr. Cato, one incident, I'm not going to go into any details, where, you know, that type of follow-up happened. And so Whatever was on the camera, it may have been nothing, it may have been something, was lost because we have a limited life. In the budget that I have recommended to the council, District of Columbia is going to fund as an additional subsidy additional exterior cameras at the stations in D.C. And we now have only one exterior camera in the entire system. That's at U Street. You don't have to go into this now, but I would appreciate a little bit more detail on whether that's been helpful or not. We had testimony before our committee that it was helpful, and that has led me to support additional funding for more cameras outside stations. And we would like your recommendation as to what stations are the best stations in D.C. to put these cameras in. Are you in any discussions with the chief of police in the District of Columbia?
Yes,
regarding this network concept that she has?
Yes, the JOC. We were there probably about 2 weeks ago, and we were given an orientation. In fact, they have Metro stations that are already up and running in their system, so they have access to seeing what we're doing here as well.
So we're in the District of Columbia, we're on our way to being interconnected in terms of these cameras?
We are connected in some of the stations, in particular those PROTECT-related stations.
What about other jurisdictions?
I'm not familiar with other jurisdictions.
That may be an issue of interest. I don't know. Finally, I have to ask this. I should. My law school professors would be very unhappy with me right now. But larceny,
yes, sir,
includes presumably theft from auto rather than theft of auto. Right?
Absolutely.
Does it include anything beyond theft from auto?
It could be theft from a person. It could be theft of, like in the Commonwealth of Virginia, if it's in your possessive control. It's not a robbery, but it's close to you. It's considered a larceny, and dependent upon the value, it's either a felony or a misdemeanor.
So we've got burglary, which is very low, larceny, which is the highest category, and robbery, which is the second highest category. So that there is an interrelationship between larceny and robbery in terms of understanding the crime that's being committed.
Absolutely. The preponderance of the larcenies are associated with vehicles still in the GPS, still in the airbags, still in the hubcaps, things of that nature. But the robberies, what we found recently over the last year, they are juvenile related in the sense that they are gangs of 2 to 3, and the victims are usually juveniles as well. And the majority of the types of robberies involve electronic iPods, things of that nature. We found that recently. Usually a snatch.
We had a couple of very good arrests.
Absolutely.
By Metro Transit Police in the District of Columbia. I don't have any other. Mr. Lenta?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
How are you doing this morning?
Fine, sir.
Great. Let me ask you, I want to pick up on this councilman's question regarding cameras. What's our proposal and how are we standing right now in terms of camera department?
I think right now, from my understanding, I was briefed, we have approximately 15 locations that we're working to install cameras. Many of those cameras are also funded by the Department of Homeland Security, so we have plans for future cameras in those locations. But we're working to connect everything with the cameras.
An additional question. I know we are pursuing a metro channel program that we have. Have we thought about, are there any plans that I need to look at? Will we have any better cameras in the city?
Any what kind of
camera? Better cameras.
I asked, I just looked over at the head of communications and she was shaking her head negative. It's not part of that program. That program is dealing specifically with customer information as well as ads within the system.
But it is technically possible to have that.
We have not required that. We just put the RFP out there. That was not part of the requirements there, but we can look at that as we start to receive input over the other opportunities.
All right. Further discussion? Discussion. Thank you very much, Chief.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate your report. And now we have our final segment. I believe it's our final.
Yes, it is safety.
It's on safety and the system.
Right. Chief Safety Officer Ron Kill will make that presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. And if you prefer, I could do my presentation in 2 minutes, if you like. So quick background on the Department of System Safety and Risk Management. The Chief Safety Officer and myself has been authorized by the General Manager for the management and oversight of what we consider system safety, occupational safety and health, accident and incident investigation, fire protection and emergency management, construction safety, environmental management, workers' compensation, third-party claims, and insurance. Also, I have been given the responsibility for advising executive and senior management on all safety policy and related matters. We have right now 7 functional areas that we are concerned with. We have corporate safety, bus safety, rail safety, of course, workers' compensation, third-party claims, insurance, and environmental management. And in our efforts to, like, broaden the scope of safety, we currently have 6 field offices. We have one at Carmen Turner Facility, one at the Glenmont Rail Yard, one at the Shady Grove Rail Yard, one at the Greenbelt Rail Yard, one at Alexandria Rail Yard, and one at the Bladensburg Bus Division. Look at statistics for, and this is for the first quarter through third quarter, and with a comparison to FY07, you can see that a large majority of these statistics have gone down. Rail passenger injuries are down by 44%. And that, when we talk about onboard, that's in the rail cars themselves. The rail transit facility occupant injuries are down by 38%. Our rail injury rate has remained the same, and that's due to the fact that in FY08, we have more passenger miles, that is, ridership is increasing, so the injury rate has remained flat. Escalator injuries are down by 50%. There are no rail collisions at all. We had the one derailment out at the Mount Vernon Square Station. And fire incidents are down by 43%, and we can attribute that to the operations department for some of the ingenious methods they've come up with. We've really reduced these fire incidents by a tremendous amount. Same thing with the smoke incidents. They're down by 5%. For bus, our bus passenger injuries are down by 18%. The preventable bus collisions are down by 8%, but the non-preventables are up 8%. And our bus injury rate is down 33% when we compare FY08 to FY07. And that concludes my presentation. Did I get under the 2 minutes?
You did. And a good report.
And a very positive report as well.
Thank you, sir.
Discussion?
Just the question. Help me with the preventable versus non-preventable. They hit us, we hit them.
Yes, that's exactly it. We can't control the traffic out there, and as you know, the traffic in D.C. is increasing every day. So our buses take a hit. That is no knock on you, sir.
Except for baseball games, they all take Metro.
But yeah, we know during the summertime, as in tourist season increases, we have more and more buses in this area, and so we do get accidents that are beyond our control.
Further discussion, Mr. Zimmerman?
Not on this side.
Not on this subject.
Correct.
Part of the committee. Oh, okay. Further discussion. Further discussion. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Keel. I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Zimmerman?
I just want to know if there was a section, the report on weddings in Metro.
Oh. We can bring that back to you, if you'll like.
I mean, we got how many pages? We got the front page. We got the Metro page. Did you see the paper?
It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. I've seen some reports in the past on people who met on Metro and got married, but this is the first time I've seen one with a wedding on Metro. Babies, I heard.
Okay. Further discussion? I just have a little suggestion. I made the suggestion years ago and then promptly forgot about it. I want to make it again. Could you have, and we all know each other, but could you have a little name, you know, not expensively produced and permanent, but just a little name placard for people who are coming from the staff to testify or to provide information, so we can begin to associate more of the names.
Yes, sir.
Speaking, I think I would find that just helpful. It doesn't have to be anything very elaborate. It's readable. It should be readable.
Okay.
Would you be willing to do that?
Absolutely, but I'm not going to write it because it wouldn't be readable. So we
and you don't need
done.
One, okay. Mr. Cato, but you know, but others, okay. Since we get accustomed.
Along the line of both of those comments, Mr. Cato noted the sound system in here. If I remember correctly, all the furniture, at least here at this table, some of the chairs are older, is about 30 years old at this point, and we have some problems periodically on sitting in some of these chairs. I don't think the board would object if some of it, you know, within budget, some of the chairs and tables were replaced and the room were updated a little bit.
Don't replace
this. In the other room.
Don't replace this chair. I like this.
Okay. So we put your name on this chair. In
chair.
There.
I don't see anybody objecting among the board members.
I understand the direction.
Okay.
The only thing, and to dovetail on what the chairman was saying, in terms of the name placards, if as the speakers were coming up, particularly if they're not the regulars, if they just identified themselves, that makes it easier as well.
Okay.
Okay, no further business. Then this meeting of the, I can never remember the name.
Customer service.
Everybody else remembers the name, so I don't have to. This meeting of this committee is adjourned at 10:15 on May 8, 2008. Thank you all.